Welcome to the Global Politico. I'm Susan Glasser, and each week, I'm taking you backstage in a world disrupted. We feature interviews with leaders in Washington and around the globe who can help us understand an international world that can seem like it's spinning out of control. Join me every Monday for new episodes. Subscribe, rate us, write a written review on Apple Podcasts or whatever your preferred podcast platform. And you can always email me at sglasser@politico.com. And now, to today's show. This is Susan Glasser, and I am delighted to welcome you back to the Global Politico, and delighted also to welcome our guest this week, Ambassador Ron Dermer of Israel. He is probably one of the savviest members of the diplomatic corps, both about the politics here in Washington and connecting Washington to what's happening back in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. So I feel like there's a lot to ask him about on both.
We hope soon it'll be just
and both capitals.
Just washing him back to Jerusalem and Jerusalem.
Well, exactly. So that actually is a great segue into our very first subject here today. Lots of people, talking once again about what, if anything, is going to happen with the United States and its long deferred but long held promise to move its embassy to Jerusalem. We can talk about two scenarios. One, the Trump administration says in the next few days that it will, and the other that it doesn't. What do you think about that?
Well, sometimes there can be 10 different scenarios in those two scenarios. But look, I think that the Trump administration made clear the last time that they issued the waiver. As some of your listeners probably know, it's U.S. law to move the embassy, actually, to Jerusalem, and it has to be waived by the president every 6 months. And so last time when he waived it, he said it was a question of when, not if. And so now the second time is coming around during his presidency. And I've expressed before that I do believe that this president will be the one to move it. I think there's a question of when you actually move the physical structure of the embassy. There's a question of when you would recognize Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. You know, it has been our capital for 69 years. It's been the eternal capital of the Jewish people for about 3,000 years. So there's this connection to it. It's where our seat of government is. It's where our prime minister sits and the president of the country and our parliament and our Supreme Court and everything else. It's a bit of an aberration. I'd say it's a terrible aberration. We're the only country in the world whose capital is not recognized. And we hope that will change, and I hope that will happen in the days ahead. We'll have to wait and see.
Now, tell us what the significance is of that discussion about moving the embassy in the context of the very interesting set of conversations that you have been a participant in with the Trump administration around how to restart the peace process.
Yeah, I think a lot of people focus, they take the embassy issue, or I would say the recognizing Jerusalem as the capital and they connect it with the peace process. But as you know, the peace process with the Palestinians began in 1993. Jerusalem's been our capital since 1948, 49, 50, when we actually moved everything over there. So what happened in those 45 years? Why was the capital not moved at that point? And if you look at the history of it, you see that the UN decision in 1947 that called for two states for two peoples actually made Jerusalem an international city. And towards the end of the Truman administration, beginning of the Eisenhower administration, there was discussions about possibly recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And I think the Truman administration should have done it at the time. Of course, at that point, we were only in half of Jerusalem, because between 1948 and 1967, the other half of Jerusalem was under Jordanian occupation. But the Truman administration didn't do it. The Eisenhower administration didn't do it, largely because at that point they thought that appeasing the Nasser regime in Egypt was a smart policy. It didn't turn out to be such a smart policy over time. But there was always a new reason why you wouldn't move the embassy that has nothing to do with the peace process. Now, since the peace process began, this argument has been made. Don't do it because it'll undermine the peace process. In fact, the bill to move Jerusalem, interestingly enough, to move the embassy to Jerusalem,
right,
was in 1995.
Exactly.
And if I remember correctly, I didn't check my notes before I came in here, but if I remember correctly, Yitzhak Rabin was the prime minister at the time and was very supportive of the effort to move. So here was a person who was championing peace with the Palestinians, and he had no issue, and he wanted I think he may have been in Washington at the time when they had finally finalized this legislation. He wanted to see it moved. I don't think it's going to undermine the peace process at all. On the contrary, I think it will actually lay a cornerstone for peace, because what it says is that under any peace agreement in the future, Jerusalem will be the capital of Israel. That's clear. If somebody could show me any kind of peace plan that doesn't have Jerusalem be capital of Israel, you know, I'd like to see it. Every single peace plan that's ever been put down has Jerusalem be a capital of Israel. There have been other peace plans that have suggested it be capital of two states, which is a separate issue.
Sure. But I think the issue here, right, is really one about timing and, you know, does it belong as part of a broader set of proposals that, by all accounts, the Trump administration is working on presenting and has been working very closely with you and others in the Israeli government on. So let's pull back and tell us a little bit about
I think
that.
The timing is being driven because you have this law every 6 months.
Right. No, clearly.
That's why it's coming here now. And I think the president was very clear during the campaign about what he wanted to do. He was clear the first time of the, during when he did the waiver the first time. That it was a question of when and not if.
It's been reported that he was persuaded only at the last minute, really, not to do that by Jordan's King Abdullah, among others. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, that was much earlier than the decision. The Jordanian king, if I recall, was here in very late January, very early February. So there were some reports that right out of the gate in the first few days of the administration that they wanted to do it. But I think the decision came to a head the first time at the end of May, beginning of June last time, and now it's coming here at the beginning of December. And I just think it will not – the decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital does not prejudge negotiations between the parties on any of the issues that we face. So I don't think it will undermine it. Look, there is an effort to delegitimize Israel, period. But specifically, there's to delegitimize the connection of the Jewish people in Jerusalem. I mean, you have these decisions that are taken at UNESCO that say, since the Western Wall, you know, has no connection to Judaism, there was a decision at the UN Security Council a year ago, which essentially says that the Western Wall is occupied Palestinian territory. So we can keep playing these games in a farce and pretend like Jerusalem's not the capital of Israel. It gets to the point it's ridiculous. We're the only country in the world. There's a lot of disputes around the world, a lot of territorial conflicts around the world, but we're the only country in the world whose capital is not recognized. I don't think the United States recognizing Jerusalem as a capital will prevent any sort of peace agreement from happening in the future. That it's not actually a sensible argument. What it will do is it will right a historic wrong. Something that should have happened 69 years ago will finally happen. And then we have to get about the process of trying to advance peace between the parties. I think the message that it will send to the Palestinians is, hey, wake up. Understand that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. You have to deal with that reality. Now, they may say what the parties want to decide in the future is up to the parties to decide. But like I said, there is no peace agreement on the table that has ever been proposed that doesn't have Jerusalem as Israel's capital. So what are we talking about?
Ambassador Dermer, I am taking away from this conversation that you are sounding to me like you think that this is happening or some version of this is happening. But we'll see. So I know we're
I'm just reading press reports.
Well, that's a good thing to do as well. That understates pretty significantly what I'm told is your role in these conversations with the Trump administration about what the nature of their peace initiative is going to look like. Tell us what you can about how that process has been playing out, you know, who is involved from the Israeli side and what your hopes and expectations are.
Well, we've had now with the new administration, it will be almost a year, about 10 months, 11 months now. And they've obviously put a team that is very close personally to the president, led by Jared Kushner, Jason Greenblatt, who's been with President Trump for over 20 years, David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador in Israel. And I think they're all involved in this. And what they're doing is speaking to different parties and trying to understand, you know, what their major concerns are. And we've made that clear to the administration, and I found them to be excellent listeners. And I have to tell you, Susan, that I'm actually quite optimistic. I hate to raise expectations because I think the key to a success sometimes is low expectations. But I speak as somebody who was against the Oslo process. I wrote about it at the time. I was against the disengagement from Gaza. But I see right now a window of opportunity that didn't exist before. And the window of opportunity, the change, is because of the change that is happening in the broader Arab world and their view of Israel. Many countries that formerly saw Israel as an enemy now see Israel as a potential partner in addressing their primary security challenges. And so first and foremost, Iran, the rise of Iran, the empowerment of Iran has created a big change in the dynamics in the region. The second was the rise of ISIS. And even though ISIS is on the downswing, that's just, you know, a Sunni militant Islam 2.0. And there may be a 3.0 or a 4.0. And I think many of these states, particularly in the Gulf, are very concerned, both of radical Shia fanaticism and radical Sunni fanaticism. We just had this this case a week ago of this terrible attack where over 300 people are killed in a mosque. And that should remind everybody, and I hope all your listeners understand that, that the greatest victims of the forces of militant Islam are actually the Muslims who do not accept their radical ideology. So here you have states in the region who are very concerned about this rising tide of fanaticism, whether it's in a Shia branch in the regime in Iran or a Sunni branch, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood, other offshoots. And they see Israel as a potential partner in solving these issues. That's new. That did not exist 10 years ago. So it's not – I know a lot of times there's a focus on which players are in what portfolio, but you have to look at the strategic map, if you will,
right,
and the environment you're facing. Yeah, and it's completely changed. And so what would be possible 10 years ago or impossible 10 years ago may be possible today. And I think the way that this administration has gone about it very quietly, you haven't heard a lot of stuff, you know, sort of leak out. I don't think that's a sign of them doing nothing. I think that's a sign of great seriousness, of keeping a very, you know, close hold on this and trying to see, given these new realities in the region, if they can advance a political process that is sustainable. And my optimism stems from the fact of these changes that are happening create, I think, a strategic environment that make the prospects of reconciliation, of a broader reconciliation, greater than they've ever been in the past. Whether Palestinians will choose to cross a psychological Rubicon that they haven't crossed in 70 years, that remains to be seen. Remember, the beginning of November was the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration.
Well, that's right, and which really set the, you know, the contours for the debate even now.
It says, well, all it calls for there is that the right of the Jewish people to a national home.
Right, but that is still a very controversial issue.
Well, if that's a controversial issue for anybody, then there's no point in even discussing any peace process, because that doesn't even talk about a state. That talks about a right of Jewish people to a national home. Now, the Palestinian leadership say they want to sue the government of England for the Balfour Declaration 100 years ago. That's a problem. The end of November, a few days ago, we also marked the 70th anniversary of the partition resolution. Now, what did the partition resolution that I referenced before on Jerusalem? It said a Jewish state and an Arab state. It was two states for two peoples. The Palestinians don't like to talk about it that much because they rejected it. And a lot of the issues that a lot of the people who follow the Middle East peace process take very seriously as being the core of the conflict, none of them were there in 1947. It was two states for two peoples. There were no Palestinian refugees. There were none of these post-67 settlements. Everything that everyone says is the core reason for the conflict, they didn't exist. It was two states for two peoples. And the partition of the land was dramatically different than it is even today, meaning a better deal for the Arabs, both the Palestinian Arabs and the broader Arab world. It was rejected because they refused to recognize the legitimacy and permanence of a Jewish state in any boundary. That remains the core of the conflict. And I say that to end the point. Will the Palestinian leadership cross this historical Rubicon to accept the permanence and legitimacy of a Jewish state? I think that's a big question mark. I think that many of the governments in the region are prepared to cross that Rubicon. Whether the Palestinians are prepared to do that, I don't know. And I think the administration is trying to get a feel for the waters, and they're not in this to fail. They're in this to succeed, and I think that's why they're taking their time, and I think very smartly, and I think they're doing a good job of advancing this, and I'm hopeful.
All right. There's an awful lot to unpack there, but let's stick for one second with the question of the involvement of the regional players and the extent to which they have a new or different attitude about Israel as opposed to the shift in the region. So clearly, Jared Kushner and others in the Trump administration have been trying to open up new channels of communication between the Saudis, for example, and the Israelis. What are concrete examples of how that has changed anything? I think a lot of us noticed that even in the midst of this internal Saudi shakeup, that Abu Mazen was also summoned to meet with the Saudis in the middle of this, the new crown prince. How has he changed things in a specific way?
Well, look, my view of the crown prince is clearly trying to take Saudi Arabia in a different direction. And I think that's something that everyone should frankly applaud. It shows a great deal of boldness. You would think that maybe he would sort of sit back and wait to take power and slowly start to consolidate that and then maybe do some things down the road. But the crown prince has been very bold in his decisions. There was the issue of enabling or permitting something that should have happened probably decades ago, women to drive in Saudi Arabia. And I found his speech that he gave recently in Saudi Arabia where he talked about the importance of confronting extremism. He talked about returning to an Islam that existed before 1979, before the radical forces, by the way, in that year. Both of those radical forces that I spoke about before, the radical Shia branch with the revolution in Iran, also the radical Sunni branch, the attempt to take over the mosque in Mecca and the subsequent events that led to a much broader takeover of the educational system both in Saudi Arabia but around the world. There were dramatic events that happened in 1979. In a negative direction, and the crown prince was talking about taking it back to a different type of Islam, a moderate Islam that had existed before. That's a very important statement coming from the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. But what I found particularly interesting is he talked about how young people are in Saudi Arabia, and he said, we don't want to wait 30 years to take on these forces of extremism. We want to do it right away. And then he immediately moved to do something within Saudi Arabia and confront corruption and other issues. So to me, looking back from the outside, it's quite impressive what he's trying to do. And I hope that he wants in this struggle between – I'll put it this way. In the struggle between modernity and medievalism, it's clear to me that the crown prince is on the side of modernity.
Right. But how does it affect Israel? For example, many people looked at his actions in Lebanon and their pressure on the Lebanese prime minister to resign and said, well, somehow we're going to get the Israelis to confront Hezbollah in Lebanon. Is that possible?
Look, we have a sovereign nation and we make our own decisions. We are very concerned with what's going on in Lebanon. We are very concerned. Israel's very concerned about what's happening in Syria because essentially what you have is an Iranian takeover. They're trying to build a land bridge from Tehran to Tartus. Basically, they obviously control Iran. De facto, they're trying to take control of Iraq. They're trying to establish this land bridge through Syria, and they also control Lebanon. They're also working in Yemen, essentially to establish in Yemen through their proxy, the Houthis, to establish there a force that can confront Saudi Arabia as Hezbollah did to our north in Lebanon. They're trying to Hezbollahize, if you could say, the Houthis, and they're trying to turn Yemen into a Lebanon for Saudi Arabia. And so this is of great concern for us. And we have very clear lines in Syria, and we intend to enforce them in Syria and Lebanon. And the prime minister has been very vocal about that he's not going to allow for game-changing weapons to get into the hands of Hezbollah.
Do you think the chance of conflict in Lebanon is higher today than it was, say, 2 years ago?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's no question. And it's much higher in Syria. And part of the problem was the nuclear deal that was signed, which empowered Iran. Iran was facing massive sanctions pressures, and a tiger was unleashed in the region. That's what's happened. I mean, this whole idea that Iran was going to become more moderate and was going to join the community of nations, it led to Iran actually starting to gobble up the nations. And they've been empowered throughout the region. And I think the crown prince of Saudi Arabia is rightly concerned. We are rightly concerned. And the United States should be concerned because for the Iranians, they want Riyadh for breakfast and Jerusalem for lunch. They want New York for dinner.
And you see that basically the risks for Israel have actually gone up as the Assad regime has appeared to come closer to winning the military conflict outright. In many ways, that has raised the concern about Iranian presence either on Israeli borders or closer to it. What do you think are concrete steps that should be taken now? What are you asking the Trump administration, for example, to do to ensure that any post-civil war Syria does not impinge upon Israel's national security?
Well, it's important to understand what is happening in Syria. I mean, Assad basically is a vassal of the Iranian regime. And the forces that are on the ground are Shia militias and Hezbollah. And
what
they're
about
the
Russia?
And they're the one. No, Russia is there as well. Russia has long-term interests in Syria. Israel, by and large, does not have an issue with those long-term interests that Russia has in Syria. We have an issue with an Iranian regime that is trying to establish this land bridge and that openly calls and actively works for Israel's destruction. And if you ask 100 Israelis what they want to see in Syria, you're going to get 150 answers.
Okay. What does the prime minister want?
Wait. But if you ask every single one of those people what they don't want to see, they will say, we do not want to see Iran take over Syria. And Israel will not allow that to happen. We are not going to allow Iran to establish these permanent bases, military bases on land, sea, or anywhere else. We're not going to allow them to take over because we understand exactly what their goals are, the threat they pose to us, and we have to make sure that we're doing everything to push them back. So from our point of view, it's very important that as you go and try to defeat ISIS in Syria, that you not allow the Iranians essentially to win the spoils of that victory. That's the great concern. And we're working with the administration and we've expressed our views to them very clearly. We were very pleased with the speech that the president gave about Iran a few weeks ago. I said it was my second best day as ambassador since I served here. Obviously, the question of what was the best day, and my best day was when my own prime minister came and spoke about the dangers of the nuclear deal and what Iran posed for the region.
This was his famous visit to Congress.
Right. That was
– And we will get to that.
We can. But we're very pleased overall with their policy towards Iran, and there's not conceptual gaps between our two governments. Now the question is how do you translate that policy into specific actions, whether it's confronting the IRGC with – economic pressures, whether it's how do you deal with a theater like Syria or a theater like Yemen or a theater like Lebanon. But there is a completely different view of Iran that this administration has. And right now we are in a process of working with them of how to translate this view into practical policies on the ground.
Well, that is a very diplomatically well said way of saying that, you know, President Trump has had a lot of very tough rhetoric about Iran, as have many of his key advisors. For example, General McMaster has often been quite hawkish on Iran. But people aren't exactly quite sure yet what that means in practice. That includes the Iran deal, where President Trump has recently decertified. I'm putting, you know, sort of quotes around that because it's kind of a made-up term, but basically refused to tell Congress that Iran is in compliance with it. But the deal itself, as you know, is at the UN Security Council, so he hasn't blown up the deal yet either. Should he blow it up? I know that Prime Minister Netanyahu's formulation has been fix it or nix it.
Right.
Are we doing either of those right now? And you know, what do you think will end up happening?
Well, what the president said in his speech a few weeks ago, and when he decertified the deal, and the grounds he used was that basically the relief was not appropriate, the sanctions relief and was not appropriate to what Iran was doing. But we think he definitely made the right decision to not certify the deal. We think this deal poses a grave danger to Israel because it does not block Iran's path to the bomb. It actually paves it. All it does is at best is delay that for a few years because at a date certain in a few years, all of these restrictions are automatically removed. All of the nuclear restrictions are automatically removed in a few years. So the statements that were made a couple of years ago that says this deal blocks their path, it just is false. Now, if they wanted to say we believe with a high degree of certainty that it may temporarily block them, that would have been one thing. But to say that we blocked the path is not true. All of those restrictions on enrichment, on the stockpiling, on all of these restrictions on Iran, they're going to be automatically removed in a few years. So what does that mean? Iran will not have to sneak in or break into the nuclear club. They can just walk into the nuclear club. And while this deal is being enforced right now, Iran is advancing its nuclear weapons program. Right now, Iran is developing—
What you're talking about is ballistic missiles.
No, not just. I'll get to it in a second. You're right. They're actually advancing its ballistic missile program, which is a delivery system for a nuclear device, but they're doing something else. Iran, under the terms of the deal, is allowed to do research on more advanced centrifuges. So a lot of people, when they look at the Iranian nuclear deal, they say, and I heard this when this debate, you know, came out a few weeks ago about whether the president should decertify or not. You know, they say, yeah, we know we got all these other problems with Iran, but at least we have the nuclear issue locked up. How much worse would it be if we were dealing with all these problems and we still had a nuclear issue? Wrong. You have not locked up the nuclear issue. Had Iran's nuclear weapons program been permanently dismantled, had the centrifuges been removed, had there been no right for enrichment there would be in Iran, Israel would have been the first to support it. Why would Israel not support a deal that actually blocks Iran's path to the bomb? Because we are threatened with annihilation from this regime.
All right. We got to go forward.
It's fine. The reason why I'm explaining to you, because when people think about this problem and why it's relevant for the future, is they say, hey, we got on the nuclear side and we gave yes on the sanctions side. And yes, we have this problem. No, you gave on the nuclear side. You gave them the path and you also gave on the sanctions side. And on the sanctions side, you release this Iranian tiger. And there was a debate at the time. You remember, how much money are they going to get? $50 billion? Are they going to get $100 billion? $150 billion? That was just the signing bonus of the deal. The big money for Iran is the $1 trillion or so over the next 10 or 15 years when they start selling oil, when they have more investments coming into the country. I think the numbers, if I recall, was about 1 million barrels a day, and now it's probably up to close to 3 million barrels a day that they're selling. They're going to get every year that the sanctions have been removed, our estimate at the time that the interim agreement was signed, that the sanctions were costing around $100 billion every year and a half. Every year and a half. Now think about an extra $100 billion that goes into Iran's coffers every 18 months. Now I'd love to tell you, Susan, that they're using that money that comes in to set up a GI Bill for returning members of the Revolutionary Guard. But that's not what they're doing. They're going to use it to fund all of this terrorism, all of this aggression in the region. And they're awash in cash. What we were seeing a few years ago was Iran had to make a choice. Do I send more support to Hezbollah or do I send more support to the Houthis? Do I send more support to this, weapons to this group or weapons to that group? Now they have more guns to them and more guns somewhere else. And they're becoming a much more dangerous and empowered force in the region. And I think that's why the Saudis are concerned, and it's certainly why we're concerned.
Okay. As a keen observer of politics, which you are here in the United States, what does that concern translate into next as far as the Iran deal? Right now, there's a sort of limbo. The president has decertified it. The deal itself remains in place. So what do you think is going to happen?
So what I think what happened with the president's speech is he said, okay, I don't accept this deal. You need to fix it. And he pointed to some specific problems. One problem was the sunset clause, which the automatic removal of these restrictions. Another one you mentioned was the missiles. Another issue was the issue of inspections. Is it possible to inspect military sites in Iran? Iran says no. The United States says yes. So those are three issues that he put on the table. And what he's basically told people is, I'm prepared to stay in the deal if we fix these problems with the deal. And there's an effort underway right now to try to change the legislation in Congress.
This is the Cotton Corker bill.
Yes. And there's an effort to change the legislation to address the flaws of the nuclear deal. There's also an effort to reach out to European countries and to see if they can do agreements with European countries that are maybe are outside the deal that could also correct some of the problems. The way I would look at it is, you're not going to get a better deal, but you might be able to turn a bad deal with Iran into a good policy vis-a-vis Iran. Because I don't think the Russians, the Chinese, and certainly not the Iranians are going to change the terms of the deal, because they got the deal of the century. Why should they change it? The question is, will Europe agree to any changes if they know that the president of the United States is prepared to walk away? Now, it's important for your listeners to understand. The president does not need Congress to walk away from the deal. The president can reinstate all the sanctions tomorrow himself. He doesn't need them. He can also go to the UN Security Council and reinstate all those sanctions himself. He doesn't need to ask the Russians, the Chinese, or the Europeans, because that's how the deal was worked. He can't force the Europeans to do European sanctions, but if he wanted to, the President of the United States could say, I'm reinstating all U.S. sanctions, all the UN Security Council sanctions, and then he can enforce secondary sanctions against people in Europe or businesses, banks in Europe, who will start to do business with Iran. And he could say, we've got a $19 trillion economy. Iran has a $400 billion economy. Our banks can have about 50% of global capital flows through our banking system. Iran's is irrelevant. You choose. He could do that. And I think the Europeans know it. What they have to understand, the people who were supportive of this deal and didn't want the president to take that step, which were many, the Europeans, many people in Congress, even people within the administration at different points, what they have to understand is that the president is actually prepared to walk away. So the only choices right now is not to save the deal or to kill the deal. It's actually to fix it with some package of measures, or the president's going to walk away. And if you ask me, if these fixes are not done in a certain amount of time, that's what he needs Congress and the Europeans for, to actually fix it. If they decide not to move, not to do anything, then I believe the president will walk away from the deal. And I think he can then, not on paper, blow it up, but in practice, with the restoring U.S. sanctions, restoring U.N. Security Council sanctions, I think then he could cause irreparable harm to the deal. And that would be better than the status quo. Israel still thinks there is a path to get a fix for the deal, and the fix could be better than the U.S. walking away alone. It depends what the fix is. It depends how serious it is.
Right.
That's
so
ultimately going to be the question for us.
So at the moment, you're not advocating just blowing it up. You're saying,
no.
Can we get everybody back to the table?
What we're saying is, what we're saying very clearly is the status quo, we are on cruise control heading over a cliff. And when people say Iran is not violating the deal, it's like saying the cruise control is working. It's irrelevant. We are heading to a cliff in a few years on the nuclear side, and we're heading to a cliff very, very soon on Iran's regional aggression. And so we say we need to turn the wheel into a different direction. If the United States walks away, that's better than cruise control over the cliff. But there may be another path, and the path is people who were for the deal, people who were against the deal, working together to address the flaws in the deal. And even you remember covering this a couple of years ago, a lot of people who voted for the deal gave very long statements at the time saying, yes, this is a flaw, this is a flaw, this is a flaw, this is a flaw. But on balance, I think it's better than the alternative, so I supported it. Well, this is their chance to plug the holes in the Swiss cheese. And he's giving them the opportunity to do that, the President of the United States.
If the Iranians will play ball, which
no,
we don't,
they don't
know
need
yet.
No, that's
we don't know yet.
No, you don't need the Iranians. The Iranians are actually irrelevant to this process. If you think the Iranians are going to do anything, then I think people are mistaken. The Iranians will never agree to a change in this deal. They won't. Only if their regime were threatened with collapse would they ever agree to change the terms of the deal, because they have a clear path to the bomb and all the sanctions relief. The question is whether or not the Europeans and bipartisan support in Congress will be there to make changes. And the only reason why it would be there is because people are confident that the president will walk away. Because if the Europeans don't want to do anything to fix it, and they have to understand the president's going to walk away. And I think given their alternatives, they might as well work with the president to try to correct these deficiencies. And there have been some signals from Europe that they're prepared. Macron, for instance, the president
the French
of France.
Have been here this week in Washington.
He said, I'm prepared to work with the United States on ballistic missiles. They have also said, both the French and the British, that we want to deal with what happens when the sunset clauses are removed, what happens when they kick in, I should say, in 10 or 15 years. So if the British, if the French, if the Germans, I think those are the three critical partners, if they're willing to come to an agreement with the United States on issues outside the deal, plus the changes in the congressional legislation, you might have a package of measures that would, as I said, turn what we think clearly is a bad deal into a good policy. And it's interesting. The two parties that were most supportive of what the president did on Iran, or two voices, were Israel and the Arab states. Mm-hmm. The Europeans were the most opposed. With all due respect to the French and the British and the Germans, we're in the region. When your allies in the region are telling you that this is bad, the policy, people should pay attention. We were the guinea pigs of this great experiment, which has gone very bad, doesn't block the path to the bomb, and now you see Iran taking over the Middle East. And we're telling you, your allies in the region that this is very bad. And there's a should be moral weight to this, which I think was dismissed when the Iran debate happened. You know, you have an issue in North Korea, and you had six-party talks with the North Koreans for years. Two of those parties at the negotiating table were the South Koreans and the Japanese. So your allies in the region were there at the negotiating table. Not only that, they were I won't say diplomatically, but they were pushing both the Clinton and Bush administrations to come to an agreement. Now, that carries weight. With the people who are on the front lines who have the most to lose if things go bad are telling an American president, whether it's Clinton or Bush, do the deal. Here in the P5 plus one, Israel was not at the negotiating table. The Arabs were not at the negotiating table. Both of us were telling the United States to not do this deal and the other parties to the deal. We said publicly what we said privately. The Arab states privately had the same position we did. Publicly, they took a different position. But it was clear to everybody who bothered to have an off-the-record conversation exactly where, you know, where the Arabs were. And somebody told me once, if you're not sitting around
the table,
right, you're usually on the menu. And so the people who've been on the menu for this experiment think it's very bad and that there should be a correction. And I hope people who supported the deal and who want the deal to continue would actually use the opportunity that the president gave to actually correct the deficiencies of the deal. And I do think there is some support for that in Congress. It's going to require more effort. I think there is more time, but I don't think it's endless. I think if the president sees nothing happening.
First quarter next year?
I think maybe somewhere between the end of the first and second quarter. I think the president to give 6 months to 9 months to an effort to try to get a fix, that seems to me to be a reasonable period of time to see if he can get it. You know, obviously, you know how the calendar works here. Everybody's focused now on taxes, and it takes time to go from issue to issue. So I think you can give a reasonable period of time to see if your partners, the Europeans and in Congress, if there's a support for a correction. And then we'll see what's on the table. And then the question for Israel, the critical question for Israel at that point will be a very simple one. Is the U.S. walking away by itself and starting that process of restoring sanctions, U.S. sanctions, Security Council sanctions, and everything else that goes with it? Is that better than the package that's on the table that may be imperfect, but it might be better than that alternative of the U.S. walking away by itself? And that's a question I can't answer because I don't know exactly the package that's on the table.
Right. Well, that's right. And that's still obviously early talks with the Europeans, including these discussions that have been happening here in Washington this week. So, Ambassador Dermer, Israel is, I think, one of only two major countries in the world surveyed by the Pew Research Center, along with Russia, where the United States and President Trump are more popular today than during the Obama administration. In our European allies, in other countries in Asia, obviously there has been a huge plummeting in confidence in the American president, according to all surveys. So,
did they poll anyone else in the Middle East?
Why is probably, if there had been extensive surveys in other Arab countries, you would have found that as well. Why is President Trump so popular there? And also, given that Prime Minister Netanyahu has probably been one of the most publicly supportive of President Trump of any world leaders, you know, I remember him clapping after President Trump's UN General Assembly address in September. Maybe you can help us. What have you and your prime minister figured out about Trump whispering and, you know, giving us a read on, you know, a somewhat unpredictable new president?
Well, first of all, about the issue of the polling, you know, what always struck me years ago is that Israel, I think, was the only place that both President Clinton and President Bush were wildly popular. That was at sort of the ends of the Bush administration.
Right.
It was the only place to have both because both were seen as sort of stalwart champions of the U.S.-Israel alliance and was strong. And Obama's support was less, I think, because a lot of the attention in the media was always on the differences between our two governments. And that's what Israelis saw a lot of times. That's what Americans saw a lot of times. But actually, there were many things and that we are grateful that President Obama did. We did sign, and this I was involved with a lot deeply, a memorandum of understanding on long-term military assistance that was actually signed during the Obama administration because obviously in the media you always focus on the differences. You focus on obviously a major difference over Iran, a difference on the best way to advance peace. Sometimes you lose sight of actually all the positive things that are happening. And there were many positive things, the intelligence sharing and security cooperation and many other things that happened during the Obama administration. But as to the question of President Trump and his standing in Israel, look, President Trump was very clear during the campaign where he stood on issues that are very important for Israelis, the Iran issue being one of them. I think the support for Israel in terms of standing with Israel, both in terms of its security and also standing with Israel at the UN, which is a big deal. Don't forget, at the end of the Obama administration, you had this decision that we were vehemently opposed to at the UN, and now you also went to having Ambassador Haley at the UN, and probably as strong a support or stronger support that we've gotten at the United Nations than under any previous administration. So that's very strong. And so Israelis are just looking, is he supporting these policies? His first visit as president of the United States, his first visit includes Israel. That had never happened before.
But he's really raised the expectations, President Trump. Is that what it's about?
With Obama, we had disagreements out of the gate, and that affected it because it was I was there with the prime minister on his first visit to the White House with President Obama, and then there was tension over the issue of settlements at that point, and then immediately the Cairo trip came later. So I think it was obviously in these things in politics all the time, it's the context and how things are perceived. But I think in President Trump, the Israeli public see a person who has really been steadfast in his support for Israel and has lined up the prime minister and President Trump are lined up on the major strategic issues facing the country. Now, we still obviously have work to do as administrations ensuring that that's implemented in all these different theaters. I mean, you have an aircraft carrier. It takes a long time to turn around. Israel, as the prime minister likes to say from time to time, we're a speedboat. You know, we can turn very quickly. You are a big aircraft carrier. And so the president had a review of policy, in this case, on the policy of Iran. It take about nine months. He declared what his policy is. Now that's got to move through the administration. On the peace process, he entrusted a team. And they're working closely with us, listening to us. And so it's just been a different approach, and we're very appreciative of it. And we're very appreciative also of the support, the moral support that we've gotten at the United Nations. Now, that doesn't happen without President Trump, but Ambassador Haley has been absolutely terrific. And we think we are optimistic, and something the Prime Minister spoke about a couple years ago, that in the years ahead, we might be able to actually crack the automatic majorities against Israel at the United Nations and other bodies, because the story that nobody reports on is that Israel's diplomatic standing is actually better than ever. The narrative that was here for many years is that Israel was becoming increasingly isolated in the world, and it was totally false. Our relations with countries around the world are expanding very dramatically. The prime minister this week had his third trip to Africa in 18 months. He will be going next month to India. The Prime Minister of India came, first Prime Minister in India's history, to come to Israel in July. Our relations with India, with China, with Japan, with South Korea, with Africa, first Prime Minister to ever go to Australia, first Prime Minister to ever go to South America. So all of these countries are deepening their ties to Israel. And the reason why is not because they joined the World Zionist movement. It's because they see in Israel a partner for solving problems that they have, first in security, because we have one of the formidable intelligence services in the world, and we have a lot to offer in terms of security, also in cyber. And second is technology. Israel is this innovation nation with technology in agriculture, in water, I said cyber, autonomous vehicles. There's remarkable things happening. And so if you're looking around the world, who can partner with you to keep your citizens safer and to keep your citizens or get your citizens more prosperous, Israel is a great partner. That's why all these countries are coming to Israel, and that's why we're going to them. And what we was lacking for many years was we didn't have those bilateral relations. So even if we would have had a great champion of Israel sitting at the United Nations, or the White House, it doesn't matter. The bilateral relationships were not strong enough to all of a sudden translate that into support in multilateral institutions. Now the bilateral relationships are. What we needed was a tailwind from Washington to actually carry that through. And we got one. Her name is Hurricane Haley, and she's doing a pretty good job.
Now, Ambassador, I know we're going to get the hook soon, but Ambassador, you raised the United Nations. I have to ask you, there's an indictment out today of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and one of the things that was very interesting about that indictment was apparently spoke with the Russian ambassador to the United States, and one of the subjects that they discussed on the telephone was this late in the Obama administration move at the United Nations that Israel vehemently opposed. And it appears that the Trump team, before they became into office, was talking to the Russians about voting against this measure that was vehemently opposed by the Israelis. So were you consulted about that? Were you aware that the Trump team was working with the Russians to try to go against a resolution supported by the United States?
Well, I interviewed on this last year when the Security Council vote happened. We approached the Obama administration during December of last year, and we told them, don't do this at the United Nations. This is a big mistake. It will only undermine peace. It will further delegitimize Israel. And we asked them in every way possible to not do this to us at the United Nations, and they decided to go ahead and do it anyway. They did not veto an anti-Israel resolution at the UN. And when I spoke to the Obama administration officials at that time, I said, we will reach out to everybody to try to prevent this.
Including Donald Trump.
We would reach out to the Trump officials who was a president-elect. He was a president-elect, meaning he is in charge of the foreign policy of the United States moving forward. And what shocked me is when everyone said publicly at the time, hey, only one president at the time, what shocked me is imagine that President Bush, on his way out the door, would have moved the embassy to Jerusalem, would have recognized Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights, and I don't know, four or five other things. Do you think people would have all said, wait a second, President Obama can't speak to somebody and say, look, we don't want this,
Okay, so you talked to the Trump people, but did they tell you they were talking to the Russians?
We spoke, understand, we reached out to members of Congress in both parties. We reached out to officials. We reached out to foreign governments. We were doing everything we could as a sovereign government to prevent an anti-Israel resolution from moving forward.
So that's a yes on the Russians.
And if the president's team reached out and who they reached out to and all the details, you know, I don't know. But from our point of view, it was the more the better, because they were actually not only helping Israel in that case, they were helping themselves, because here the president of the United States said, and he said it during the campaign, he wants to do the ultimate deal. He wants to have a policy. And the question is, why did an outgoing Obama administration not consult with an incoming president about an issue that is so important? Why did he not do that?
Ambassador, I know that you agreed on a policy sense, clearly, with the Trump team. Nobody doubts that. Everybody understands that that was the case. It's a more narrow question. Were you aware that they were going to talk to the Russians on your behalf?
We were hopeful that they would speak to anyone they could in order to divert this, in order to prevent this vote from happening. And I would be shocked if people look back every 8 years or 4 years when there's a change of administration, that a new president-elect does not have his team, nor understand also in terms of Mr. Flynn, I believe at that point he was the national security designate for doing it. I would be shocked if other administrations in that transition period did not reach out to foreign governments. And if I'm correct, I think the Obama administration did in its last year in office when Bush administration was still in. We had a war in Gaza at the time. It was a different administration. But it's constant conversations with different governments. So what exactly he said or didn't say, I don't know. But obviously, we reached out to them in the hope that they would help us avert what would be bad for Israel and bad for the United States.
So just one last time, did you personally speak with Michael Flynn about this?
I'm not sure if I spoke with Flynn directly, but I definitely spoke to officials in the administration. And I also, by the way, told the Obama administration. I told the Obama administration even before that don't do this, because we will reach out to everybody to help us avert this thing.
Did you talk to the Russians?
I personally know.
No. Okay. Well, I appreciate your patience on this. I know that people just want to, you know, try to pin down and clarify the facts. So we're going to get out of time. I want to just wrap it up on a final big note here, which is a year from now, what do you say are the percentage chance that we have a peace deal?
Oh, a peace deal. Peace deal, that's a big word. Too big, two words, I should say.
I know. You said you're an optimist. So
I'm an optimist. I'm an optimist that we can be in the next year in a serious political process that moves towards a broader reconciliation in the region. I would put those chances as moderate to high, that we could be in that process. Again, whether the Palestinians 71 years after the UN resolution, the partition resolution, will cross a Rubicon that they haven't crossed in the first 70, I'm a little more skeptical about it. But it might be that the chances of them crossing the Rubicon will go up if they see that the region is prepared to reconcile with Israel. We're already blessed with a peace agreement with Egypt. You know, last week we marked 40 years till Sadat's historic visit to Jerusalem. That peace agreement has weathered many storms and has lasted 40 years, despite two wars in Lebanon and three wars in Gaza and two intifadas and all the problems. And today, Israel's relationship with Egypt is stronger than ever. We've been blessed over 20 years with a peace agreement with Jordan. So we've already made peace with two of our neighbors. And the hope is that we'll be able to expand that even more. I think the chances of doing that and beginning that process of expanding it are actually higher than people think. Whether or not the Palestinians will cross the Rubicon, I think that's the ultimate question. I haven't seen internal signs that that's the case. You saw this reconciliation between different Palestinian factions. I haven't seen any change in Hamas whatsoever. I haven't seen that the Palestinian Authority is prepared to accept the permanence and legitimacy of a Jewish state. The fact that they want to sue Britain for Balfour doesn't give me great hopes that they're ready. But maybe if they see, hey, everybody else is moving towards reconciliation with Israel, that there's a process going on, then maybe they'll understand if the train's leaving the station, maybe they have to get on board. And that would make us all, I think, all better off, Israelis, Palestinians, and everyone else.
Maybe is a big word. Okay. Percentage chance that a year from now there could be a new military conflict with Hezbollah?
Well, I wouldn't put a percentage on that, but I think it is higher than people think because of Iran's continued push through the region. If Iran is not rolled back in Syria, then the chances of military confrontation are growing. I don't want to tell you by the year or by the month. I'd say even by the week. Because the more they push, we have to enforce our red lines, and you always have the prospects of an escalation, even when parties don't want an escalation, because we will not allow Iran to establish that presence again and establish another terror front against Israel in Syria. We're not going to allow it to happen. So in taking action to defend ourselves, you don't know what could happen, but I think it's higher than people think.
Ambassador Ron Dermer, the final word is yours. You know, these days, Washington is a more interesting place maybe to be than Jerusalem for you.
Yeah, well, I said in our Rosh Hashanah event earlier this year, I said this is very hard for me to admit, but for the first time in 69 years, Israel is a more boring place than America. And one of the things I would tell to people to explain to them how exciting it is in Israel, and you were there for a very brief time. Period. Yes, we'll take a rain check on your visits
there. Accepted.
But I used to tell people to explain how exciting Israel was, that Israelis go to Manhattan to unwind and to relax. And any Israeli who's listening knows that that's true. Nowadays, a lot of Washingtonians need to go to Tel Aviv to relax. So we're used to it. It's very exciting. But what I will tell you as Israel's ambassador to the United States is that the relations between our countries are actually stronger than ever. And despite all the difficulties and all the challenges we have, as we look ahead to Israel celebrating its 70th birthday, it's hard to imagine that the founders of Israel would have imagined that we would have a country so strong, strong militarily, strong economically, strong diplomatically, and also I have to say, maybe this is for the next time you invite me here, also strong in terms of its values, given the challenges that Israel faces. I don't think they would have dreamed that we would have had this in 70 years. And so it's a great privilege to serve as Israel's ambassador to the United States, and I think our relations are going to get even stronger in the years ahead.
Ambassador Ron Dermer, thank you so much for joining the Global Politico. And, of course, thank you to all of our listeners for joining us once again on iTunes or whatever is your favorite podcast platform. You can always email me anytime at sglasser@politico.com. Thanks again.